10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the morning show comes from the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, offering a new online sports management master's degree. Learn business skills for today's fast-paced sports environment. Details are available at uwp.edu. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Spending the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show with an outstanding writer by the name of Devin Gordon. Perhaps you have seen his work in various places, including GQ Magazine and Newsweek, and he is responsible for a wonderful new book called So Many Ways to Lose, the amazing true story of the New York Mets, the best, worst team in sports. Devin Gordon has been a faithful and, in a sense, beleaguered fan of the New York Mets for decades. And his new book is, in a sense, a celebration of that strong connection which he has felt with the New York Mets, these many years, through the few mountaintop peaks and through all of the long, lengthy, sad, frustrating valleys that have been part of the New York Mets history and legacy. It's a fascinating book. It is not an exhaustive history of the ball club, and yet this book is packed with all kinds of interesting information about some important moments in the ball club's history and some of the really important figures who have been part of that history. The book is published by HarperCollins, again titled So Many Ways to Lose. And Devin Gordon, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you for such a beautiful introduction. I love that. That's great. Thank you. Glad to be here.
I'm really glad that I can be talking to you. Maybe we could talk first about, in a sense, what this book is not. I mean, all of the different books that you could have written about the New York Mets and the book that you ultimately decided to write.
Well, you know, as a lifelong Mets fan and having read so many of the standout books that come out about our team, you know, you notice that all the stories tend to be about 1969, when the Miracle Mets won the World Series, and 1986, when the Mets won the World Series. And as Mets fans know, those are very, very isolated experiences. And for a lot of Mets fans, those are experiences that happened before they were even born. The reality of the Mets, what it is to be a Mets fan, is all the years in between. And I think that that's actually a pretty universal thing. The moments in between for Mets fans, I think, are maybe more dramatic and more colorful. But, you know, you guys are in Milwaukee, right? There's
right.
Ups and downs. There's no juggernaut in your town. Consistent winners, sometimes. Mid-level team. Oh, you guys are surrounded by just an all-star cast of losers, though, right? You've got, like, losers on all sides. The Lions, the Vikings. Wow. It's terrible there. You guys should feel good.
What is interesting about the story of the Mets, because, of course, there are plenty of teams in professional sports that that have struggled for one reason or another, what, of course, creates a special dynamic for the New York Mets is their proximity to another certain ball team known as the New York Yankees. And I think you explore some really interesting things in your book about the contrast between those two teams, the contrast between their respective legacies, and certainly contrasts between their fans, all the way down to the color scheme. Let's, in a sense, start with the color scheme, but take it from there and tell us more about what makes these two ball teams so dramatically different from each other, and in a sense, how the Yankees then set the Mets' story in a certain dramatic kind of contrast.
Yeah. I mean, my Mets fandom goes back to childhood, 7 years old, 8 years old, like a lot of boys getting into baseball. And if you don't inherit it, like I didn't inherit a team from my folks. And if you didn't inherit a team but got really into baseball, the criteria which you were using was the kind of criteria that seven-year-olds use to make a lot of choices. And for me, I'm choosing between the Mets, who were orange and blue and had this sort of fun, just look radiating off of them. And then the Yankees are sort of dreary and dark blue, navy pinstripe uniforms that look kind of like prison uniforms, and nobody's allowed to have long hair or mustaches. They don't have names on their back. It does feel a little bit like they're in prison and they're playing for their lives. And there is kind of that weird contrast that kind of echoes through their franchises, this winning machine in which winning is the one thing and the only thing, and all else is a failure. Being there historically, having the not just a robust history of success, but the robust history of success, being the definition of sports success. And then you're the little brother who comes along, even almost like a second marriage, because there were teams, but they left, and you were the one who came in. And it's with the Yankees, it's not just like having a big brother that's really successful and way more accomplished than you, but it's also like, you know, you come home and your parents have put some of his extra trophies in your room, you know, that sort of thing. It's you keep getting reminded of how much better and successful and admired and lauded, you know, all, you know, the Yankees have tons of books written about how great they are, and that's just who they are. And the contrast is important, as you say. Like, most people tend to think of bad teams in isolation about their performances, right? The Sacramento Kings, I suppose their fans, the three or four of them, could make a strong case that the Sacramento Kings in isolation are worse than the Mets in some kind of way. But the stakes for this are so much broader. It's the narrative. Sacramento isn't being contrasted with anything. They're almost forgotten and isolated. The Mets have this giant spotlight on them, you know, sort of showcasing not just how bad we are, but there's this perfect metric in comparison. Mm. There's this scale right next to us. You can see just how small the Mets are by this shadow that we're sitting in. And that informs the dynamic in all ways, but I kind of enjoy that because it's liberating to just enjoy every minute of every game. The Mets can have, like, 2019 was one of the most entertaining Mets seasons I've ever been a part of. I think the Mets were in third place. They went 83-79 or something like that. There is no way the Yankees could have an 83-79 season that in the fans' mind was anything but an utter disaster. And that's, I don't know, that's kind of a bummer for them.
Hmm. Yeah, there is something, as you said, kind of liberating about not wearing that mantle of not only greatness, but expected greatness every second of every day of every season, and in a sense the expectations for the Mets are different. I mean, and in a sense it helps you savor more of what they do than would otherwise be possible.
Yeah, and you know, that's baked into the franchise's DNA. Right, it goes back to the very beginning, 1962, the way the franchise was created, right? The Dodgers and the Giants leave, huge fan bases just gone, a hole, you know, two giant holes blown in New York. The Yankees are all that's left, and they're wholly unacceptable to a huge swath of the city, but they're also the great, awesome team. The Mets join as an expansion team. They have to pluck their roster from just a beyond dismal pool of players. They have no chance of being good. They're going to be awful, but they're going to be very, very visible too. And the genius inspiration of their founding owner, Mrs. Joan Whitney Payson, the first female professional sports owner to create a franchise, own it outright herself, not inherit it, by the way. I mean, she should be a civil rights hero. But she had the brilliant insight that this team wasn't going to be good, but they had to be fun and likable. Otherwise, things would turn really mean and people would tune out. They had to be an entertaining team. They had to be likable. They had to do. They had to, their appeal had to go beyond winning and losing. That was baked in. That's why the Mets hired Casey Stengel to be their first manager, because he was so funny, and he could let he could lighten the mood for what was obviously going to be just an endless, perhaps years-long run of losing, which in fact it was. And when you start that way, when you're built to be fun, when you're not built first and foremost to win, it's like any other DNA. It echoes through eternity, right?
Wow. Very, very well put. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Devin Gordon about his new book, So Many Ways to Lose, the amazing true story of the New York Mets, the best, worst team in sports. I'm anxious to ask you about Joan Whitney Payson, who you just mentioned, but a couple of other overarching questions first. One of the things that is intriguing about this book is that it says a lot about your love of the New York Mets, that you do not love every single thing about the New York Mets. And there are some sports fans who are so devoted to whatever team that has their heart that they see everything through a certain sort of prism. And you clearly do not. There are things that make the New York Mets lovable, but there are also moments in their history that are anything but that. And I don't want to get into any of those specifics quite yet, but I just want to ask you in general about what it's like to be that kind of a fan of the New York Mets, in which your love and admiration for them is by no means unstinting or across the board. And what is it like to write a book like this in which you are highlighting not only some heroes and some kooky characters, but also some dark, very troubling themes as well?
That's a great question. I mean, you know, and I do worry slightly that, you know, Mets fans will see a book titled So Many Ways to Lose and think it's just a trashing of their franchise, right? You know, the fact that it's coming from an affectionate place, I hope, is clear by the tone on the cover. But it's, you know, what you're describing is very much a phenomenon, right? That somebody's going to look at the cover of my book or hear about the book and not have a sense of humor about it, because a lot of fans really do not have a sense of humor about their team or just have too much of the emotion bound up in it. And I've had moments like that, certainly. I think it's just as a combination of two things. My journalistic background, right? I've spent 20 years as a journalist. Newsweek, you know, when I was at GQ, I wasn't doing the fashion and style stuff. I was doing the long-form features. And so my approach to looking at almost everything is going to be through a, you know, as objective an eye, or at least as reportorial and factual an eye as I can possibly tell it. And the simple reality is, Mets history just does not hold up to hagiography. You know, it just doesn't. Like, there's no, if I'm going to write a book about Mets history, it can't be a story of winning and success and glory. I mean, that's just ridiculous. It's not true. But beyond that, I just instinctively think the stories are better when they're more complicated. And winning is fundamentally a fun thing to watch as a sporting event on TV and a boring thing to read about. Winning is not a particularly good story to tell in a book, especially if it's a victory that you've already experienced. In fact, that's often, to my mind, the kinds of books that get written, and they tend to be the least effective because what they're really doing is drafting off of an emotion that they can't possibly conjure. You know what I mean? They can't. The real thing was the thing, and every attempt to retell it, at least when the object is winning, the goosebumps rise a little bit lower each time. And the better stories, the ones that really affect you, are maybe the ones that you don't necessarily know and sometimes end in losing. Every chapter in this book is a story of losing.
Right.
That's the prism of the book.
Right. And that's in some ways kind of the fundamental human experience. Most of us lose more often than we win, and often the reasons we lose are a lot more interesting than the reasons we win on those certain occasions. I know that this
book, what's that old line, tragedy is comedy is tragedy plus time, right? that's an old storytelling line. And what is, you know, let's be honest, this book is an act of catharsis and trying to make lemonade out of lemons, right? I mean, this is, you know, it's as a human, as a person, it is my instinct to try to laugh at the things that may immediately cause me pain.
Right.
And you know, that's where we are.
Explain to our listeners the article that was kind of the launching pad for this book. Explain to our listeners the article you wrote for, was it the New York Times Magazine, I think?
Yeah, it was, yes. It was about the trio known as Gary, Keith, and Ron. Among Mets fans, that is our broadcast booth, Gary Cohen, and our 86 World Series heroes, Keith Hernandez and pitcher Ron Darling. They are, to my mind, the best broadcast booth in baseball. And I will confess, you know, I haven't listened to them all. I've listened to a lot of them. And I'm not sure what you guys think of your Brewers booth. But our guys are just incredible. And the article was about, I think it was out, I can't remember if it was 2018 or 2019, but it was yet another season the Mets had just gotten off to a horrible start. A really deflating start in which we had kind of gone into the season with some promise. And the piece was about what it was like to be the best booth for the worst team. What is it like? What is the job like when you're really, really good at this, but what your job really is keeping people entertained through catastrophe? And, you know, the piece fundamentally was about Gary, Keith, and Ron. But the subtext of it was the comic agony of rooting for a loser, because Gary, Keith, and Ron are also very fundamentally Mets fans. Gary's a Queens guy, lifelong Mets fan, and of course, Gary, you know, Keith and Ron are Mets, ex-Mets. And when the article came out, it did pretty well. People seemed to like it, and got some calls from publishers saying, "Would you like to write a book?" And the answer was no. I've worked in magazines my whole life. Books are really long. There's a reason why I chose magazines. But after a conversation or two with one editor in particular, it became clear that what they were really asking was, is there any way you could turn your Mets article into a book? They didn't care if I could write a book or wanted to. They realized that maybe the Mets had a book that I could make. And what the book became was sort of turning the subtext of the Gary, Keith, and Ron article into the text of the book, which is what it is to give your heart to a loser and to tell a history of the team, because fundamentally I'm a journalist and I care about the history, and I didn't want to just write a fan love letter. It seemed to me that unlike a lot of the things that we write history about, politics or whatever, sports is really a subject that is almost impossible to tell the history of objectively, because the fan experience is so much a part of the objective sports experience, right? It feels almost inextricable. As long as you're copping to it, there's a difference between bias and subjectivity. My book is very subjective, but I don't think it's biased. I try to be very unbiased in my view of the Mets, but while admitting that it was completely subjective, this is very much my vantage point, and it is very much the vantage point of a lifelong Mets fan.
Right.
And it'd be disingenuous to not cop to that. But I don't think, and I hope when people read it, that they believe every word, you know, that they don't think I'm pulling any punches, because, you know, when, you know, there's a full chapter about Mike Piazza in the book, but I feel like I'm pretty candid about his strengths and weaknesses, both on the field and off. One of the things I like about Mike Piazza, so is he. It's a very messy thing to be, right? Self-reflective, showing your wounds, showing your flaws. And that in itself became sort of the core of a chapter, right? Like Mike Piazza versus Roger Clemens in the World Series, there's a whole chapter about that in which Roger Clemens is like the epitome of a Yankee, right? Just win at all costs, no matter what. Even if it ends up ruining your legacy, like it has for him. Piazza is such a Met in that regard, right? We ended up losing. We stood down in a moment of brutal confrontation when there could have been a fight in the World Series, but Piazza actually restrained himself because there was something deeper than winning at stake in his mind. There was just principle. He just doesn't go around punching people for no reason. He just doesn't, even if he thinks it could wind up his team and inspire them to some emotional victory, he just like has this rule against punching people for no reason, you know? And that's a very, very messy contrast. So even there, it just seemed like you could sort of chop up Mets history into this identity that we have that just keeps repeating itself and repeating itself and repeating itself and repeating itself. And by the way, we'll probably continue to repeat itself despite all of Stevie Cohen's billions. It is so adorable how optimistic Mets fans are right now.
Right, exactly. Of course, that's one thing you say at one point. The mental state of your standard issue Mets fan is to be simultaneously certain of humiliating defeat, yet pretty darn sure that there's a miracle brewing. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Devin Gordon. We're talking about his book, So Many Ways to Lose, The Amazing True Story of the New York Mets, the Best Worst Team in Sports. One of the things that I think is very commendable about your book is that although we certainly get to know some very, very well-known figures in baseball history and Mets history like Casey Stengel and Tom Seaver and Daryl Strawberry and so on, that there are also some people that we should know better because their stories are so compelling. And one of the most important is someone I want to give you a chance to really talk about, namely the aforementioned Joan Whitney Payson. I mean, there would be no book because there would be in a sense no New York Mets without her, and yet it is a story that is so largely forgotten, even sort of buried. Explain to our listeners first of all just how significant she is and explain why nobody remembers this name.
Well, like I mentioned earlier, Mrs. Joan Whitney Payson, and that's Whitney as in the Whitney Museum of American Art, that's her family. You know, her father worked for a president. Her grandfather worked for presidents. She, you know, her family basically built America. And she was a huge sports fan. Specifically, she was a huge New York Giants fan. Even more specifically, she was a huge Willie Mays fan. And she was also awesome. Just fun. Loved going to nightclubs. You know, she was an Upper East Side society matron who did all the charity dinners with the museum, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But she really liked sports and comedians. And when she owned a tiny, tiny, tiny piece of the New York Giants, and when the New York Giants moved to the West Coast, to San Francisco in 1957, which she was the only vote against among the shareholders, she was heartbroken. You know, this is 57. This is not MLB TV, right? There's no Twitter. When your baseball team moves across the country to San Francisco, when Willie Mays moves across the country to San Francisco, he's gone, right? He's gone. The Giants are out of your life. Willie Mays is out of your life. And the Dodgers moved at the same time, right? Brooklyn Dodgers. So there's a long series of machinations that leads to baseball, like some New York power brokers basically forcing Major League Baseball to expand. But by virtue of her connection to the Giants, her money, her influence, and her just general likability, she is offered the chance to own the Mets, and she accepts, and she's the reason why the Mets are named the Mets. She is the person who had the brilliant, genuinely brilliant, and humble insight to know that her team was going to be laughed at and going to be a joke, and that if they didn't sort of steer into this, it'd be really mean and potentially toxically destructive to the franchise. And so she hired Casey Stengel, and she built the team to be fun. And in part because we live in a sexist society, she got erased from Mets history. But in some ways, she got erased for even dopier reasons, which is Fred Wilpon wound up buying the team as part of an ownership group around 1980. And owned it until just a year ago. And Fred Wilpon was a Brooklyn Dodgers fan. I mean, loved the Brooklyn Dodgers. Grew up going to Ebbets Field. Was an actually very good high school pitcher and college pitcher until he got injured, and actually often threw batting practice at Ebbets Field to the actual Brooklyn Dodgers. his high school buddy was Sandy Koufax. He was better than Sandy Koufax in high school, by the way. Koufax preferred basketball. But because of this, because Fred Wilpon was so reverent toward the Brooklyn Dodgers, all he cared about was the Brooklyn Dodgers. And once he bought the team, the New York Giants part of the Mets history kind of got erased. You know, most Mets fans, if you ask them about their history, they're well aware of all the Brooklyn Dodgers stuff, because if you go to Citi Field, you can't miss it. It's literally you walk in through Jackie Robinson Rotunda and into a stadium that is almost exactly a mirror image of Ebbets Field. There's virtually nothing about the Giants present in Mets history, and that includes Mrs. Payson. You know, she spent, from the day she got the team, it was her dream to get Willie Mays in a Mets uniform, and she finally did it when he was 41. But that part of the team, we remember Willie Mays being on the Mets. We're very proud to claim that. We're very proud to claim Casey Stengel. We're very proud to claim our franchise. But the woman who is responsible for it has a plaque in the Hall of Fame with 30 other people and a tiny entrance in the very back of the stadium, and that's it. She's gone. There's no Joan Payson Day. And I opened the book with her because, you know, this is not an activist book, but to the extent that there is an agenda, I would love the Mets to do right by Mrs. Payson and celebrate her, because it's a very proud thing. The Mets should be really, really proud of this. And instead, it's something that we don't even talk about. Most Mets fans don't even, if a Mets fan knows her name, they've heard Mrs. Payson. That's it. That's all I knew going into the book. And I'd love, if nothing else, for this book to do some small thing to help fix that.
I want to touch on her insight that you were talking about in terms of how it was really important for this ball team to be entertaining in the most lighthearted possible way, given the fact that they were almost certainly not going to be scoring much in the way of tangible success in terms of wins and losses and so on. And they certainly managed to do that, and that's one of the things you explore a bit in your book. Early on, when you are contrasting the Mets and the Yankees, you say there is no such thing as a funny winner, and go on to say that the Yankees are not funny, and neither are their fans. They snicker, but they don't laugh, you know, when it comes to matters of baseball. And of course, by contrast, we see a very different kind of ball team with the New York Mets, and especially in the early going. Tell us about the ways in which some of these first Mets teams were so funny.
First of all, they just had amazing names. I mean, this is, you know, this is something that you come across when you're researching a baseball book in particular, set in the 50s, 60s, 70s. Baseball names are the best. And the 62 Mets had Vinegar Bend Mizell and Choo Choo Coleman and Elio Chacon. And they had two Bob Millers, a lefty Bob and a righty Bob. And they made them share the same hotel room on the road because everybody got so frustrated. They got so frustrated that people kept calling the wrong Bob Miller that they put them in the same room. So if somebody called looking for Bob, they'd definitely get a Bob. They might not get the right Bob, but they'd get a Bob. And there were just things like that all, you know, Casey Stengel telling jokes about the team, Marv Throneberry being the most famously incompetent Met of them all, sort of the mascot of the team. Famous. He's sort of a power hitter. And a pretty good one, except that he had a habit of hitting doubles, but forgetting to touch first on the way around. And, you know, when I say a habit, I don't just mean like it's a like a joke that, you know, it happened once or twice in some big situations and, you know, he became sort of famous for it. It happened a lot. Like, it was like he just didn't get that you had to touch the base or something like that. And he actually famously once hit a two-run scoring triple and was called out on appeal at first base. Casey Stengel came out of the dugout to argue, but before he could get a word out, the umpire said, "Save your breath, Casey. He missed second base too." And this is true. Like, this is not like a urban legend. This really happened. And it was the sort of thing that happened every game. The Mets 62 season, when they lost a still standing major league record, 120 games, they clinched loss number 120 by grounding into a rally-killing triple play. That's how their season ended, a triple play. It's just, if you scripted some of the things that the Mets did in 1962, and you were giving, like, you're an editor giving notes on the script, you'd send it back, you're like, you've got to dial this back. This is too preposterous. No one would believe that.
Yeah, right.
Like, you know, and that's really who they were, because I went into the book knowing that the 62 Mets were sort of a comic team, and so I was bracing myself for comedy, you know, but I didn't know that they gave a houseboat to their only 300 hitter that season, Richie Ashburn, and it sank immediately. It sank. They gave them a gift of a houseboat, and the boat sank. This is the sort of thing, I didn't know that going in. I knew they were bad, but I didn't know I didn't know about any houseboat sinking. But you start digging in, and there's just stories like this all over the place. And I mean, I spent half my research of the 62 team just laughing.
Not a bad experience for an author digging into the details. And of course, the deeper you dug, the more interesting this story becomes. Of course, it's not all lighthearted laughter, and there are some very, very serious chapters in your book as well. And one of them, chapter 8, is called The Voyage of the Clotilda. At a glance, I think even a fairly rabid baseball fan is not going to know what you explore in this chapter. Explain where you take us in this chapter called The Voyage of the Clotilda.
Well, this chapter is about the three African-American Mets who were sort of the offensive core of the 69 title-winning team. It was Cleon Jones and Tommy Agee, who were left fielder and center fielder, who were actually boyhood friends, lifelong boyhood friends from Mobile, Alabama. They both were very poor in Mobile, Alabama. And Don Clendenin, who is a veteran who had been acquired in the midseason from the Expos via the Pittsburgh Pirates, where he was sort of a team leader. Clendenin, they grew up in very, very different experiences of the same Jim Crow Black American South. Tommy Agee and Cleon Jones both had horrific, nightmarish incidents of racism that blew apart their families. Grew up very poor. Don Clendenin grew up sort of among Black American academic royalty and also sports royalty. His father was a math professor who died young, but his mother remarried a Negro League All-Star who was also college professor. And Don Clendenin's college big brother mentor at Morehouse was Martin Luther King Jr. So you have, you know, these, what was interesting to me was these teammates who came from such contrasting places in the South and had, as a result, very, very different careers. Cleon and Tommy had very up and down, troubled careers. And Clendenin, who was probably the least talented purely of the bunch, had the most stable, rock solid career and was just had a great, you know, was going to law school and just was built on solid ground. The Clotilda was the last slave ship brought to America before the slave trade was banned and the Emancipation Proclamation was handed down. This was in 1860 in Alabama. It was a bet between a couple slaveholders that you could sneak a slave ship in under Lincoln's nose at this time because the feds were supposedly cracking down. And this guy, this captain, said he could do it. And so he built a very fast ship called the Clotilda and brought over the last ship filled with slaves, 110. And he got caught. So because he got caught, the slaves got turned free. But free is sort of a relative thing. They were dumped basically on a patch of land along the Mobile River in Alabama. And they, many of them did not speak the same language. They wanted to go home. They didn't know each other. They were frightened, dumped, and they sort of built a town for themselves called Africa Town that came to be sort of a almost Eden, a refuge, until sort of the 20th century when it fell into ruin and disrepair and isolation and extreme poverty. And this is where Cleon Jones grew up. And the chapter is fundamentally about Cleon because he was the first great three-hole core backbone hitter in the Mets offense. And the Mets just ran him out of town. They just humiliated him again and again and again. And so Africa Town is where he was from. Africa Town is where he lives now and has returned to. And there was something about the voyage of the Clotilda that sort of resonated with me about Cleon's own life in baseball, in America, with the Mets. And the fact that he went back home, that he came from there and he went back home and, you know, has been trying for years and years to build it back up. You know, this Eden for his people, for his ancestors, has just really resonated with me.
Wow.
Especially since we did him so wrong as a franchise.
I appreciate
so,
also.
You know, that's kind of a thing. That's a twist, right? That's a very unusual thing, I think, to put in a sports book, especially one that's been pretty goofy until this point.
I also appreciate the way in which you explore in some detail the story of Doc Gooden and Daryl Strawberry, two of the most gifted and skilled ballplayers with this team, and the way in which they were not handled very, very well. At one point, you write, the cruel clumsiness of baseball's care for Doc and Daryl lays bare the degree to which they were out of their depth. I leave it to our listeners to explore that portion of the book. I want to give you a chance, however, in our last couple of minutes to talk about the interesting story of catcher Mackie Sasser. And more casual baseball fans will not know his name or story at all, but he was someone who came down with a terrible case of what's known as the yips. Explain a little bit about his story and how interesting it was for you to follow up on him and on his life.
Mackie Sasser was one of the reasons why I wanted to write the book. He was sort of the kind of character that I envisioned building a book around, was an ordinary figure in Mets history, because those are very often when when you love a team, the deepest parts of your connections to them often come as much from players like Mackie Sasser, who is a very gifted hitter, as they do from the stars, like the superstars that everybody knows about, like Daryl Strawberry. Daryl Strawberry was my favorite player. He's the reason I became a Mets fan, because, you know, if it was the blue and orange uniforms, it was just as much because I was 7 years old and Mets had a player named Strawberry. And when you're seven, that's really cool. Mackie Sasser came along a few years later. He was the catcher who was going to sort of keep the dynasty going. You know, our older catcher, Kerry Carter, was the captain of the team, is broken down, retired. Mackie Sasser was going to take over. And boy, could he hit. He was a country boy from Georgia, and he could smack the ball over the field. And he was busting out. But as he was busting out as a hitter, he was started developing this weird condition, psychological block, where the only thing he couldn't do is he couldn't make the simple routine toss back to the pitcher. And like a putter or a golfer who can't make a one-foot putt, or sometimes you see it in baseball, it's often a second baseman who can't make the simple throw to first. And what's weirdest about it is if they have to do it in a hurry, like if they dive and they have to hop back up, they can usually make a throw. It's when it's easiest, when they have to stop and think about it, that suddenly they can't get the ball out of their hand. That's what Mackie had as a catcher, only that throw was throwing back to the pitcher. And it ruined his career. Within a year and a half, he was out of baseball because he was ruining the pitchers. They didn't want to throw to him anymore. And eventually the block sort of seeped into his hitting, and it just took over his career. And he finally got sent to the American League where maybe he could DH, but then he got injured, and then he just washed out. And he went back home, and he started managing a community college baseball team. That's what he's been doing ever since. But he did figure it out. He figured out what caused the yips, and I wanted to tell that whole story. And most importantly, I wanted to tell it because I knew it didn't have a fully happy ending, and I kind of prefer it when stories don't have happy,
right,
1% happy ending.
It's complicated, but a fascinating, powerful story, and I'm so glad you tell it. Here's the last thing you dedicate the book to. I'm assuming several, maybe family members, names I didn't recognize, but then to Andy Chavez. Tell us why he has such a special place in your heart and a special place in this book.
Well, you know, I was saying that, you know, Mackey is one of the people who were, you know, was the kind of player who was the reason I wanted to write the book. It was him, it was Mackey and Andy. Andy is one of my very favorites. I dedicated the book to him because he was the author of the most exhilarating postseason catch I've ever witnessed and that I think there has ever been. And I was actually there live in person for it, which was the home run saving grab he, home run robin grab he made in game 7 of the 2006 National League Championship Series, a catch that should have put us in the World Series if we had gone on to win the game, which of course we didn't. And Andy was just one of those utility players who was not physically overwhelming. So he was never going to be a superstar. He was just super good at baseball. He could do everything really well and especially play defense. He was an electric, exciting outfielder. And he made the greatest play of his career and the greatest play I've ever seen in the biggest moments of his life. And I am so heartbroken that he doesn't get to go down in baseball history for it. And I feel like not just he's been robbed of history, but it was almost even worse. It was like his name got written down in the history books and then they crossed it out. Mm. And I as an Andy Chavez fan and lover and worshiper, that was a reason to write a book like this, was to be like, okay, well, I'm going to write him into history. He got left out because of the game, but at least he gets a chapter in this history of the Mets, because he deserves a chapter in the history of the Mets. Somebody's got to write it. So, all right, it'll be me. Mm. And I love him. And I love that catch, and it was such a fun chapter to write. And we lost. So, again, even in this, you know, my favorite Mets moment, with one of my favorite all-time Mets players, is in the service of what ended up being the most excruciating defeat of my Mets life. And, you know, so that's, I don't know, that seems like the stuff of literature a little bit, right?
Absolutely. The book, again, is So Many Ways to Lose, the amazing true story of the New York Mets, the best, worst team in sports, published by HarperCollins. Devin Gordon, the author. Devin Gordon, thank you for this wonderful book and for joining me today on The Morning Show.
This is so great, Greg. Thank you so much for having me.
And to finish out our time, I want to read a portion of the prologue to Devin Gordon's book, So Many Ways to Lose. So many baseball fans I know have heartwarming stories about how they fell for their favorite teams, a family saga, an iconic moment to which they bore accidental witness. For me, a key factor was color schemes. The Yankees were drab and gray. They radiated no fun. The Mets were orange and blue, and the NY on their caps sprouted soft, round serifs like muffin tops. The Yankees logo was all sharp elbows, and didn't anyone else find it unsettling that their pinstripes looked like prison uniforms, like they were playing for their lives? My parents both grew up in the Bronx, an irony I've always savored, but they split up when I was 6. By the time I fell for baseball, I was only seeing my father a few times a month, which was sad for my childhood, but a godsend for my baseball future because it liberated me to choose my own destiny. I can see clearly now that baseball, sports, was a balm for loneliness, a way to be in the company of men and learn codes and rituals and feel a part of a group, however vicariously. In the real world, I didn't know anything about men and didn't get to spend much time in their company. I learned about men from baseball. I learned, God help me, from the Mets. I'd like to think that the Mets chose me in recognition of a kindred spirit as much as I chose them. What really clinched it, though, wasn't my ardor for their day-glow colors or my sense that I'd found my tribe. If I drew up a pie chart, those factors would take up about 25%. The other 75%, the number one overwhelming reason why I'm a Mets fan, is that I was 7 years old and the Mets had a player named Strawberry. That's really all it took. The 1986 Mets had a warping effect on my psychology as a Mets fan, imbuing me with a capacity for endlessly self-replenishing optimism, even when it was unwarranted by facts or logic. When I'd first fallen in love with baseball a few years earlier, the Mets were emerging from one of their most brutal stretches as a franchise, but I didn't know about any of that. I just knew they were bad. I'd heard Dave Kingman's name, and I was old enough to discern that everyone thought he was a prick. I'd watched the grainy footage they always showed during the rain delays on WWOR of Casey Stengel in his inflatable Mets uniform doing his stand-up act. I knew about 1962, the worst team there ever was. I knew about 40 wins and 120 losses, but I was far too young to grasp how rare and special the Mets' 1986 season was. It had been 13 years since their last trip to the World Series in 1973, when they lost to the dynastic Oakland Athletics in 7 games. But I knew there were plenty of fan bases that'd been waiting far longer, including some that'd been waiting forever. Besides, for as long as I'd been watching baseball, the Mets had been good. My first 3 seasons as a fan just so happened to coincide with the Mets' first run of 3 consecutive 90-win seasons. As far as I was concerned, the 1989 season, when the Mets won just 87 games and finished second in the National League East, was a catastrophe. How naive I was. I've never shaken it. Almost 40 years now, I've been like this. Stupid, delusional, and I love it. It's so much more fun than being one of those long-suffering Red Sox fans who don't know what to do with themselves now that the Red Sox are the Yankees. But that 86 team was also the beginning of my true education as a Mets fan, and the first lesson I learned was that 1986 was the anomaly, the one and only time in Mets history when the Mets were a juggernaut. Only in retrospect did it become clear what a bunch of drunks and criminals and ticking time bombs so many of them were, and how inevitable it was that they'd blow apart in spectacular fashion. By the late 1980s, it was like watching the third act of Fargo, with Dwight Gooden vanishing and Kevin Mitchell shoving teammates into a wood chipper. I didn't have the wisdom to understand this at the time, but the World Series, the winning, the dominance, the champagne in the locker room, that wasn't the Metsy part of the 86 story. The Metsy part was everything that came next. A portion of the prologue to Devin Gordon's wonderful book called So Many Ways to Lose, The Amazing True Story of the New York Mets, the Best Worst Team in Sports, published by HarperCollins. I'm Gregory Berg. Tomorrow on the morning show, in a change from what was our published schedule, we're going to be sharing with you a conversation I just finished recording with Rabbi Dina Feingold from Beth Hillel Temple and Pastor Kara Baylor from Carthage College, talking about tomorrow night's courageous conversation, Moving Beyond Denial, Racism in Faith Community, co-sponsored by Carthage and the Kenosha Coalition for Dismantling Racism. Also tomorrow, we'll be hearing from Cleo Wade about a wonderful new children's book that she has just created called What the Road Said. And on Friday, it will be Brian Albrecht's monthly visit to the program. Brian Albrecht, of course, is the president of Gateway Technical College. We'll be talking on Friday about the Gateway Foundation. And this weekend, one of the podcast editions of The Morning Show will feature a conversation recorded way back in 1996 by my predecessor on the program, Bill Guy, two local attorneys, John Mason and Mark Nielsen, talking about their work. You can subscribe to The Morning Show podcast by looking for the title, The Morning Show with Greg Berg. Support for the Morning Show comes from the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, offering an online sports management master's degree. Learn business skills for today's fast-paced sports environment. Details are available at uwp.edu. It's exactly